The Skiffy and Fanny Show is listener-supported, which means basically you guys listen and we feel really good about ourselves. But if you'd also like to help us a little bit, you can go to audibletrial.com/skiffyandfanty, sign up for a one-month free trial membership, get a free book, which is pretty cool, and the bonus is that it helps us a little bit. So go ahead and check that out at audibletrial.com/skiffyandfanty and enjoy the episode.
It's one small step for man, one giant leap for mankind.
But Dacrell forgot one thing, yes. Monsters, John. Monsters from the id.
There you go again, always blaming me for everything.
Go switch off!
It's a trap!
This looks extraordinarily bad.
Commencing countdown. T minus 5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
Welcome to the Skiffy and Fanny Show, episode 168.
I have three special guests today. I have Stina Light.
Hi!
Sarah Zattel.
Hello there.
And Mike Reeves McMillan.
Hey.
And Mike is the faraway one. He's our resident New Zealand person today. So, welcome.
Thank you.
I would hope later you will sing the national anthem for us.
You will hope in vain.
Excellent. So, today's topic is a fairly loose topic, but I thought it would be very interesting to talk about. All of us are, I think, from slightly different age groups, and so our experiences of genre will have seen changes in the way genre is maybe perceived or thematic changes, that kind of thing. So I thought that would be a really interesting way to talk about genre fiction, is to talk about how it was, and you know, when we were kids, when we first got into it, and then how we've seen or perceived changes to that, to science fiction and fantasy. Right off the bat, then, why don't we start with you, Sarah? So where would you like to start? What was the kind of experience for genre when you were first getting into it? I'm assuming as a kid, but I could be wrong.
Well, what you have to understand about me is I'm a third-generation geek. My grandfather wrote science fiction. I have some of his manuscripts. We don't know that he ever published, but he did write. My father was at the first Hugo banquet. We have the photographs. He was there. And then I learned how to read out of The Wizard of Oz. And from The Wizard of Oz, I moved on to my father's collection. So my first experiences of genre were not contemporary. They were pulps out of the 30s, the 40s, all the way back to Lord Dunsany. I read Dunsany before I read Tolkien. So, you know, I was combing through my father's library before I really understood what I was getting my hands on. In terms of, so what I have got in the back of my head is more or less the 20th century in science fiction. And it is very interesting to see both what has changed and what has not changed. Obviously, I'm limited because I only read English, and most of my experience is reading what came out of America. But going up through John Campbell all the way to steampunk and zombie punk, we have seen actually less change in attitude than I would have thought. We've seen a lot of change in language. We have seen waves of pessimism and optimism. We've seen constant waves over what was the cool science. Started out early 20th century, the cool science was chemistry. Then the cool science became physics. Then the cool science became computers, round about the time you got cyberpunk. Now I think we're shading into biology, but we're losing the optimism that came with chemistry and with physics.
So you think that we're seeing a more optimistic world now than...
No, I think we're seeing a less optimistic.
Oh, less optimistic. Okay, I'm sorry, I misheard. So you're one of those people that thinks that the all genre has gone to hell in a handbasket.
By those people. What do you mean by those people?
I tease. There's certainly a camp. Maybe not quite a camp, but there has been a lot of talk in the last, a couple of years about how science fiction is too pessimistic. It's all just apocalypses and bad things happening. And my response to that is always, but humans are still alive in these stories. So on some fundamental level, it's still kind of positive.
Well, you and your friends getting together to save the world is a very, very positive trope. It is one of the most popular of genre fiction. The problem I have with it is in apocalypse, the inconvenient people are dead. And the inconvenient people have a tendency to be minorities.
Mm.
Or if you're an American, people in foreign countries that we don't like, England is still there. Obviously, we think England is cool. But large swaths of places like China or Africa have a tendency to either be wiped out or at odds with us. And that is what disturbs me deeply about the apocalyptic strain of modern science fiction.
Yeah, that is quite disconcerting. And I just realized, since we have one international guest, Mike, New Zealand is almost never in apocalypse stories.
I don't know. Actually, I think New Zealand sometimes, because it's literally the last place that anybody got to, both the native people and also the Europeans, it tends to be a survivor in some apocalypses, just because we're so far away.
Well, yeah, I mean, I imagine it. Even when nobody mentions it, I just imagine, like, while everybody else is dying off from zombies, New Zealand's like, we're all good. We're not letting anybody in. We have water everywhere.
Yep, 1,200 miles. They're probably zombie-free. 1,200 miles from everywhere, so,
I think you're pretty safe. In a weird kind of way. I agree with you, Sarah, that in a lot of and as a great example of this is the movie adaptation of World War Z, which we talked about in a previous podcast. But there are moments in that where there's this really strange moment where the main character goes to Israel and he's like in this giant compound where the Israelites have built this big old wall to keep out everybody outside. And the obvious sort of analogy being drawn there is anybody who's not within Israel proper, who's from outside, so basically all of the Arab countries, they're the zombie ones, or the hordes that are coming in to try to destroy the country. And I don't know if that's how it would actually go down. Somehow I think that in a real zombie apocalypse of that sort, I think probably the Western countries would be pretty effed. Because we'd be the ones messing with it. We'd be like, yeah, let's just poke it and see what happens. And then we'd get bitten. In all zombie movies, everybody always is like, oh, I can't kill my zombie mom because she's my mom. And it's like, no, she's not. She's a zombie killer.
Well, what I find terribly interesting is the evolution. I mean, if we're going to talk zombies, specifically zombies, the evolution of the zombie in popular media across the 20th century has been really interesting. Because as we know, zombies, the original zombie myth, comes out of Haiti, where you can get people who have been turned into zombies via a combination of poison and extreme trauma. This is part religious ritual, part magical ritual, part social ostracism. And when you saw zombies in movies in the 30s and 40s, there was always a zombie master, and he would create a mindless zombie slave, generally for the purposes of kidnapping white women, who would then be zombified into doing his bidding.
So present company, or
right,
Dina, not good.
The social status of white women is something else. But
yeah.
Then in the late 60s, early 70s, you got the Evil Dead movies. And this is where you started getting the idea of the zombie horde, where you started getting the plague zombies and the flesh-eating zombies. Zombies that were based even loosely on the Haitian myth didn't eat, actually. They didn't eat. They didn't feel pain. They were perfectly obedient. The zombie horde is, as near as I can tell, entirely a creation of a Hollywood B movie. And the fact that that is what has taken over in popular culture and become the zombie really interests me, and it really disturbs me, because I am not sure what it says about the zeitgeist.
Stina, you put your hand up, so why don't you jump in?
Okay, so that's not the only monster that's gone and done a transition. The vampire has gone from being a monster to the bad boyfriend, if you ask me. The bad boyfriend stereotype.
Please do not mention the books that shall not be named.
Going to all the power in the world and you know, and they're always very sexy, and then they always slop tons of blood all over their expensive designer clothes, and yeah.
Well, in the Supernatural universe, the vampires are actually quite violent and manipulative and legitimately, like, they're bad guys. They're not sparkling, just to mm-hmm. right, but they're really the bad guys. They're not our heroes. They're these monsters who infect people that they want to be part of the quote-unquote horde of vampires on purpose.
Yeah, I mean, it's gone through a big transition, so
yeah.
And it originally was just how they explained death, because they would discover bodies that looked perfectly preserved, and I did a lot of reading. Really boring reading. So Mike is ready to go. Go, Mike.
Yeah, well, I want to let Mike jump in ahead of you, Sarah, because he hasn't said anything yet. So I would like Mike to speak.
Absolutely.
Okay. I have a half-formed and possibly malformed theory about zombies and vampires, that they represent our culture's fear of mindless corporates on the one hand, and actively malicious elites on the other hand.
Do you want to elaborate?
Well, the zombies are these mindless things. They're coming in hordes. You can't defeat them because of the sheer numbers. They're everywhere. You can't reason with them. And to me, that sounds a bit like a corporate out of control. Mm. And the vampires, on the other hand, think they're better than you. They're very powerful. They dress well. And they suck your blood. You know, they take away from you what you need to survive. And to me, that's the popular imagination of the 1%.
I'd actually never thought of it as that way. I mean, I've heard with zombies, like, one of the interpretations of the Romero films is that the zombies are sort of like a critique of mass consumerism, because they just eat. They're just compelled to get sustenance in the same way that, you know, mass consumption. We just buy crap we don't need for the sake of consumption. I mean, and the great example of that is, if you want to see zombies in the real world, you just look at, well, at least in the United States, I don't know how it is in New Zealand, but around like Black Friday or, you know, any of the big, huge shopping days around the holidays, people will mow each other over to get at the product, whatever it is. And they'll buy things they don't even need just because it's on sale, and they will fight each other over it and kill each other over it just to get there. And it's really, I mean, there've been people been killed in like basically like a stampede of human bodies. They fall down and they get trampled and that's the end of their lives. But in some sense, I guess you could make a kind of different interpretation and think of it as kind of a corporate infrastructure, a particularly malicious corporate infrastructure, because I guess there's like one or two corporations that are friendly. Maybe. I don't know what it's like on your end, but there may be some nice ones. I don't know. I don't know many corporations. Sarah, did you want to jump in on this? Because I know you had a hand, so I assumed it was related to what Mike is kind of bringing up too.
Well, I think Mike's interpretation is really, really interesting. I think there are two very different things happening with zombies and with vampires. And now I need to give you a warning. I have an entire feminist pro-vampire interpretation of the modern vampire myth. And if you don't stop me, you guys are going to hear it.
Go for it, Sarah.
Okay, Stina, you're not wrong about vampires and death in traditional culture. And Mike, you are certainly not wrong about vampires representing the elite. It is no surprise that the blood-sucking vampire myth comes out of areas of the world that were both extremely mountainous, extremely isolated, and where the ruling class was frequently a different ethnic origin and spoke a different language than the people they ruled over. So this was all a contributing factor to the origins of the legend. But like the zombies, modern vampires have a very, very clear pop culture focal point for their beginning, and that's the Bram Stoker Dracula book. But something interesting has happened between the Victorian era and our own. If you actually read Dracula, and you can actually look at most of the movies, we are once again protecting white women. White women are making lousy choices about whom to bestow their attentions on, i.e. Dracula, and they must be saved from their weakness and inherent victimhood by the white men. Mm. Then you get kind of this is the standard power dynamic all the way up through Anne Rice. I don't want to talk about Anne Rice. Moving right along. Then you hop over to when vampires in popular culture really pick up steam. And what you see there is they are almost an entirely the sexy vampire, the powerful vampire, the boyfriend vampire comes in entirely or almost entirely in books aimed right at women. And in these books, the women get the vampire. The women are getting to control their own choices. Whether or not we agree with the symbolic importance of the vampire, what is important here is that the women in these stories make their own choices about who to be with, and they come out okay. Now, you know, again, you can argue about bad boyfriends and good boyfriends and, you know, the potential symbolism of abuse. But what is interesting and important is that the books took off as soon as the women were empowered in at least this one area.
You just
that was it.
Shattered my brain. No, because I'd never thought about that, because you go to the bookshelf and I'm assuming, Mike, it's the same way in New Zealand. When you go to your local like book chain store, there's the YA section is just full of like vampire hot bodies for teenage readers, primarily teenage girls, and horny housewives, since that's also there. I'm dead serious. There's a whole like sea of housewives who really, really like Twilight.
You do know I am also a romance writer, so respect for the horny housewives, okay? They help pay my mortgage.
Fair point. It's just a little weird because they lust over like a 16-year-old vampire boy.
And is it weird that men keep reading Ian Fleming or keep buying Playboy?
I haven't even seen a Playboy. So I don't, what's in a Playboy? I mean, other than like nude bodies, like I know that much. Like, I don't know. Maybe are Ian Fleming books still the same way? Have they changed at all?
No.
So it's still like just James Bond running around like beating up women and. Is that like his thing? Is that? I'm serious. I'm dead serious. I have not read an Ian Fleming book.
I have.
That are being written by all these new people because new people are writing the Bond books now.
I haven't seen any of the new Bond books, no. So oh, okay. I can't speak for that, but I have read some of the old ones.
The point here is that every group has got their escapist literature. And to diss on a group because they read escapist literature is a little disrespectful.
That's a fair point. You're right. No, you're right.
It's also hypocritical.
Explain.
Well, what is genre fiction, science fiction, and fantasy, but escapism largely? I mean, hello. It's just a different type of escapism, frankly.
Exactly.
Well, that's a fair point. No.
Mind you, I don't like romance because that's just me. But
I also am not sure what that even means. Because when people say romance, I often wonder if what they mean by romance is they mean like Harlequin romances, or like sometimes they even mean like erotica. Because like there are a lot of like the other day we were interviewing Ruth Frances Long, and she writes fantasy romances. But the only reason you know she writes fantasy romances is because the book covers are the kind of the what is traditional or what seems to be very popular, which is, you know, mostly naked male, very muscular male on the cover in that kind of like Fabio Longing way. But when you read the synopses, they're not any – like if you just took the synopses and you took the cover and you didn't have the cover, you would never immediately assume this is that kind of a romance novel. Does that make sense?
Like, romance is in part in the eye of the beholder. Now, you got to understand something. You're talking about 52% of the paperbacks sold in the United States. It's big.
Oh, yeah.
It's got more subgenres than you could possibly shake a stick at. And the readership is huge. They read widely and they read fast. Science fiction readers have got nothing on romance readers when it comes to sheer volume of books. So it is very difficult to pin down what a romance novel is, largely because the genre is so big. But in general, in a romance, the relationship drives the plot. In other fiction, the plot drives the relationship.
That's interesting. Okay, when next time I read a book that could be ostensibly referred to as a romance, I'll have to think about that very point and ask myself if it's not being marketed as a romance because it does not do exactly that thing where the romance guides the plot as opposed to the plot guiding the romance. Because that's
Other thing I will say about romance is that it does compass. There are time travel romances. There are science fiction romances. They get called futuristics. There are definitely fantasy romances. The thing I will say is you are all familiar with the term Sturgeon's Law.
Yeah, and like 90% of everything is crap or something like that.
Right.
Yeah.
Because romance is such a big genre, 90% of it
is crap.
It's a lot of books.
Well, and I'll just say that the people behind the Harlequin romances make a lot of money off my grandma.
They make a lot of money, period.
That's true. She really likes them, though, because it's not because they're necessarily romance stories. She likes them because the plots are really direct. So she kind of – they're like – she reads them like popcorn literature. Like they're just really quick for her.
And that's exactly what they are. And they don't have to be anything else.
No.
Sometimes you're just in the mood for the literary equivalent of a Snickers bar.
And a Snickers bar is really good.
Exactly.
Yeah. No, I agree. I totally agree. You know, like
I am not ready for Ian Banks every single day. Some days I need me my Terry Pratchett.
Yay, Terry Pratchett!
hey, don't disrespect the Pratchett. There's a lot of depth to the later books.
This is true. This is true.
Yeah. Okay, so we've like went way far afield from our original topic, so why don't we reel it back in a bit and actually have Mike talk about the original question, which was, you know, about how how genre you perceived it as you were kind of younger, and how you think it has changed today.
Okay, well, I was a teenager in the 80s, so that gives you a clue as to my current age. Before, in my preteen years, I was reading Andre Norton and those classic kind of space opera type stories, the Solar Queen novels and those ones. I was a huge fan. And The Hobbit, of course, and Watership Down. And then Lord of the Rings as I hit my teens. And the grand old men of science fiction, the Clark, Asimov, Heinlein, the big idea, serious kind of stuff. And I will confess also to reading Stephen Donaldson, because there was a shortage of fantasy in the 80s and, you know, you took what you could get.
We've all been there, Mike. It's okay.
That's the Covenant, yes. Right? The Thomas Covenant stuff?
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Yeah, the one where he rapes a 16-year-old in about chapter 5 of the first book.
Oh, man, that would make me stop.
Yeah, it made me stop the second time I read them.
It made me stop the first time, actually, because in the second book he does it again.
Oh, I just – is it – I'm sorry. I haven't read the book, so I must apologize. But is it described or is it just said that he does it?
It's not blow by blow, but it's pretty clear that that's what happens.
Oh, no. Okay. I can't do it.
Don't do it.
Yeah. I'm sorry.
Anyway. there's a sense in which science fiction or some part of science fiction is still actually back in those days. I read a great short story, wonderful short story, Hugo nominated, published in Asimov's. It's called The Homecoming by Mike Resnick. You may have come across it. Guy who's been transformed into an alien appearance to work on another planet comes home and his mother has Alzheimer's and doesn't recognize him, of course. And it's very, very moving. But there's not a thing in that story that couldn't have been written when Mike Resnick started writing in the 1960s.
Hmm.
It was in the Hugo 2012 ballot. There's even a TV channel that stops broadcasting for the night, which I don't think has happened in 20 or 30 years. And it's like this whole big section of science fiction is frozen before cyberpunk. And then there's another section of science fiction which has gone through cyberpunk and post-cyberpunk and then hit the new space opera and going round and round. Hmm. And in terms of fantasy, as I said, not much available in the 80s. Some epic fantasies that were trying hard to be Tolkien and failing. But one of the things that's changed is that not only is there so much more genre fiction, because we've got all the old stuff as well as all the new stuff, but it's so much more mainstream. I was watching a cooking competition last night, one of the master chefs, and they happened to be doing a meal for some university students in a college that had old stone buildings. And one of the women on the show kept making Hogwarts references. And everybody knew what that meant. All of the people watching that show pretty much would know what that meant. My 80-year-old mother-in-law reads Harry Potter and knows what it means because all of her grandkids are into it. And so partly because of the fact that movie special effects have improved so much, science fiction and especially fantasy is much more mainstream now.
Mm.
And people who aren't nerdy or geeky know these properties and enjoy them and are huge fans of them. or at least people who wouldn't have counted as nerdy or geeky back when I was a teenager.
And there's some people who would hate you to call them nerdy or geeky. I'm not a geek, but I just like Star Wars and Star Trek and all this other stuff that's science fiction, but I'm not a geek.
Yeah. Well, actually, I think that's one of the interesting evolutions, at least lately.
That's true.
Is that the term geek has actually gotten itself some cred and some respect due to things like the Big Bang Theory.
That's true. Yeah, I mean, there's definitely been a – I mean, even look at something like Comic-Con, which, you know, I mean, I imagine it's always been kind of big the last decade or so, but it just seems like it gets so – big, it's actually now this, it's like a huge media event in this sort of almost like you can watch it as a voyeur now on YouTube, you know, all these people posting their little handheld video recordings of all the panels, and all kinds of people go to that. Like, there are people who are, you know, the dress up, like I'm gonna dress up as Iron Man kind of people, and there are other people who are just, I just really like the movies, I want to go to Comic-Con and meet people that are in the movies I like. They're all geeks. They're just different kinds, I guess. So, although I imagine most people go to Comic-Con probably identify themselves as geeks. I imagine they would, but at the same time, I don't know. I mean, I've never been to Comic-Con and done an official poll, but Stina had her hand up. So why don't you go, Stina?
Yeah, I just wanted to say, I personally believe that it has more to do with not Big Bang Theory. It actually was happening much previous to that, right about the time when geeks started to have money, jobs that paid them a great deal, with the advent of the electronics industry becoming so huge, that's when being a geek became more fashionable, and that's when being a geek acquired more power and more visibility, I think. Mike's got his hand up.
All right, Mike.
Well,
have at it.
I think that's also when being a geek became more common. I work in IT, and the number of people and the number of women who work in IT these days and have a lot of technical knowledge and have a lot of also often pop culture interests going along with that is much, much greater than in the 1980s. I mean, I didn't even own a computer until the early 90s. And I remember when I was kind of considered the huge nerd in the office because I had internet access at home. And these days we're all walking around with internet access in our pockets. It's just the geekiness has spread. The access to information technology, the use of information technology, people working in their daily lives with information technology, and along with that, I think, has come a mainstreaming of genre. Mm.
Sarah, you had your hand up.
I think Mike is absolutely right. I think maybe the biggest change is the breadth of science fiction and fantasy in terms of its cultural saturation. You know, again, everybody knows about Harry Potter. Everybody knows about zombies, and you know how many superhero movies have come out just this summer. It is a part of the mainstream in a way that it never was, not even at the height of the Apollo program. Everybody knows who Captain Kirk is, which they didn't when the show was running, the original series. And I have to say the original series because it keeps coming back.
It never ends.
No comment whatsoever.
No, I don't. I mean,
I'm a Trekkie. Don't disturb my Trek.
I like Star Trek overall, but my favorite captain remains Janeway, and will always remain Janeway. So,
fine.
I'm sorry, Janeway is the superior officer, followed by Patrick Stewart.
I am not going to diss on anybody's Star Trek, but I'm sorry, the best of the bunch was Sisko.
Oh, I know.
I love them all.
It breaks down like this. If you've got five Marines in a prison camp that have to get out, the guy you want is Kirk. If you've got a fleet action to fight, the guy you want is Picard. The one you don't want mad at you personally, that's Sisko.
I just love them all.
I'm sorry. I'm just going to disagree. Janeway's the best. I'm just teasing. That's not fair.
I am going to so respectfully disagree with you that I think we should probably circle back around to the topic at hand.
Okay. All right. And I know, Stan, you've kind of jumped in a little bit already, but why don't you take your stab at the question?
Oh, so I came at science fiction when I was in kindergarten, and Star Trek, the original show, was on television, and it really... What I remember of it was my association with science fiction and fantasy, mainly science fiction, had to do with this positive outlook and liberalism and all of the really positive changes that were going to happen and human rights and all of these really thinky topics were being addressed. Maybe not so well, you know, because the old show isn't exactly perfect by any means. But there was that going on. And then I also was like a huge fan of Dark Shadows, which I haven't seen in a million years. And if I had, I would probably be horrified how campy it is. But I loved it. I really did. I loved it. It just, I remember screaming every time Barnabas Collins came on screen, and my mother forbidding me to watch the show because I was just too loud. And so I would go to a neighbor's house and we would watch Dark Shadows together. And her mother instantaneously understood what was going on and said, okay, I'll tell you what, if you don't scream, I will make popcorn for you and you can watch all the Dark Shadows you want. So we did. So that was my first start. And then as far as books went, then it was definitely A Wrinkle in Time and
Yay!
Sarah's got her hand up. I don't know if I should continue, but mainly that was my main association. And it hasn't been until recently that I began to realize that there was actually a really heavy duty right wing aspect of science fiction that I was completely unaware of that had obviously been around for quite a long time that I had managed to somehow not see, which is fine. But it just kind of shocked me to realize it, that there was a group of folks that didn't want women to be a part of science fiction and didn't want minorities to be a part of it. All of it just sideswiped me like crazy, which is kind of dumb, but when you think about where I came from, it really shocked me. It really, really did. So for me, that was a stunner. But there you go, Sarah, go, Sarah.
Well, what I was thinking of is if we're talking about science fiction tropes and the shows and tracking the evolution of science fiction in the media, we really don't have to look any further than Doctor Who.
That's interesting. So tracing the changes as sort of iterations of different doctors over time?
Iterations of different doctors over time, and also at the massively successful comeback that the show has made. Okay, among my first organized fan activities was being the president of Time and Relative Dimensions in Ann Arbor, the University of Michigan's Doctor Who fan club. I got costuming prizes for my Doctor Who costumes. But when I started out in the 80s, I mean, Doctor Who made you nerdy among nerds. you could not get more disrespected than being a fan of this children's show with lousy special effects, which mostly involved people running up and down plaster corridors. You know, the Star Trek fans look down their noses at you. And yet now, Doctor Who is cool. It hasn't just grown up, it's hip. Which stuns me on a regular basis.
Yeah, I'm not a fan.
Wait,
I know,
whoa,
I know, it makes me horrible. I'm a horrible person. I don't like Doctor Who.
All right, well, let me find the little red button to get rid of you. No, jeez.
Oh, no!
No judgment. We do not judge here.
See? Listen to Sarah.
Look, she's on your side, man. That's fine. You don't have to like Doctor Who.
And we can segue right into the history of science fiction of blowing people out airlocks.
There's a history of this?
You guys don't know about the cold equation?
I mean, I've heard of it. I'm vaguely.
Oh my god, this story is an illustration of absolutely everything that is wrong with science fiction.
Oh my god, is that story? Okay, I need...
Yes, that story!
I need to read it.
No, you don't.
I have to read it to understand.
Okay.
Picking it up right now.
Wait, is it... Oh my gosh. Spacewesterns.com actually republished it?
Doesn't surprise me. They probably shouldn't have, but does not surprise me.
Okay. Well, I haven't read it, so I mean, I can't judge it yet, but I suspect that... If Stina hates it, I'll probably hate it. So,
well, the funniest part is, okay, you know, it is the basic premise. A guy is on a deeply important mission in a ship that carries exactly enough fuel to get him to the planet, which I believe is suffering from a plague, and he's got the antidote, and he discovers a stowaway on board. Now, Campbell, John W. Campbell, the original editor of Astounding Science Fiction, who is part of what is continually wrong with science fiction, which the things that Stina pointed out have a lot of their origins with Campbell. He published this story in an effort to show that sometimes in physics wins and there's nothing you can do about it. I didn't really understand the problems with the story until my husband, who is an actual rocket scientist, said, "Who the hell designs a ship without safety tolerances? And who the hell did such a lousy job on the pre-flight check that they didn't find the kid hiding in the storeroom?"
Pardon me a moment. Yay! Yes! Go! Go!
So this is what happens when science fiction and the real world collide.
Yeah, as a practicing person who does projects for public infrastructure and so forth, a lot of what you see as the plot points of science fiction and fantasy are unrealistic, not because of the technology or the magic, but just because in the real world, people do their jobs better than that.
Namely, the film Prometheus, where clearly they didn't teach the captain not to run in straight lines in that version of the world. Don't understand why you would run in the shadow of the object about to crush you, but also, you know, of course... You know, not teaching anybody proper quarantine procedures. Also sending geologists who don't know how to use their own technology. I was not aware that that was a geology thing. But apparently geology, that's what they do. Is they just like send geologists out into the woods and say, go dig up rocks with the shovel that we haven't taught you how to use yet. Sipping.
And just in case it sounds like we're piling on modern science fiction... This has been a problem throughout. It's that, you know, you have to tell a good story. You have to tell an exciting story. But the needs of the story and the agenda of the authors, I will say, has too frequently gotten in the way of exploring the wonder not only of the physical universe that is around us, but the wonder of the breadth of human endeavor and competence that is enabling us to explore that physical universe.
Mike, you got a hand?
Yeah. Yeah. What Sarah was saying just made me think about one of the wonderful things that's happened relatively recently with the rise of indie publishing, is that now you can get stories that aren't the conventional story. And I'm thinking in particular of Nathan Lowell and Deborah Gehring, who write stories. It's they're almost the Seinfeld thing of a show about nothing. It's Nathan Lowell's first one. Sure, the kid starts out orphaned and in a and gets a berth on a spaceship. But what he does there is he improves the coffee, and he, you know, he gets to know his fellow crew people and encourages them to be better people. And he doesn't save the universe. And in Deborah Gehring's books, it's sure it's witches, it's what you would initially think of as urban fantasy, but it's really suburban fantasy because, again, world is not in danger. It's about people who are friends sitting down together and eating ice cream and helping each other through their personal crises. It's not high stakes in the cosmic sense. And if you took this to a traditional publisher, you would... they'd show you the door before, almost before you'd got the first sentence out. But Deborah Gehring has been in the top, well, at one point on the Kindle store in the fantasy division, she had four of the top five books, and number six was George R. R. Martin. They are selling like hotcakes.
Awesome.
Because people want to read stories about people who are basically nice and are getting along and are going through some personal growth without necessarily having to run around saving the universe. And who knew? Who knew that? Because as far as the publishers knew, what they wanted was the square-jawed white guy going around saving the universe.
I just find it interesting that the what they wanted, what they clearly want if they're buying these books is they want the guy who's going to make better coffee. there's something kind of really comical about that. I don't know. It's very interesting. So it's Deborah Gehring. I'll put links in the show notes so people can go check them out. And the links to everybody, obviously, but just so people can find it. I won't put links to the Cold Equations. Because I'm told that it's really bad and I shouldn't do it.
Damn. I mean, really.
I like how the description in the summary is, Marilyn saw the unauthorized personnel keep out sign, but thought she would at most pay a fine if she were caught.
I am going to be chased by a torch-wielding mob for publicly dissing this story, because in some ways it is the origin story of what gets called hard science fiction. But seriously, gang.
Oh, please tell me. No. Yeah. Jeez.
Yeah.
Did they
yeah.
not have security personnel at this place?
See? This is exactly what I'm talking about.
Exactly.
Like, I mean, you can't just like walk into Cape Canaveral and be like, well, I'm going to walk into this space shuttle now. Like, that doesn't work. You'd get arrested.
Besides, if they weren't designing it with safety tolerances and all that stuff, then they probably would have crazy security.
Yeah, you'd think, but apparently at the year in which this story, what year, it doesn't say what year it takes place in, but apparently I know what year it was published in, I just don't know what year the story the world is in, but clearly humanity got dumber over time. So, that's just silly. I'm sorry. I haven't said anything, and I guess I don't have anything specific to add what you three have said, because I agree. I think for the most part, we've covered most of the kind of the generalized stuff where, like, changes in the kinds of themes or the changes in the field, what has become popular, or even in some cases the sort of, I guess you'd say, the popularization of genre in the mainstream. The only thing I would add is there's a clear sense for me that from an academic standpoint, genre has, at least in the last 20 years, taken a complete drastic shift. I mean, it's certainly been that way since at least the 60s, where there'd been a lot of movement towards viewing science fiction in particular as a serious literature for study. But I think particularly in the last 20 years, I went from being in school and being told that you wouldn't be able to study science fiction at all. Like, it was just not serious literature. That's just, you know, fluff and silly ha-has and, you know, there's spaceships and blow up and woohoo, to now I'm actually studying this stuff. That's part of what I do. And being basically told by academics around me who aren't even in my field, who are saying, yeah, that's a completely appropriate field to study. And I think that's really, really crucial. And it says a lot about, you know, just where this genre has come. And it's been really weird because I've been reading the Samuel R. Delaney book. The book is called Starboard Wine. It's one of his collection of essays on various sort of critical things. I mean, it's similar to kind of the Jewel Hinch Jaw, but it's sort of the next step after it, and it's much more readable than the Jewel Hinch Jaw. But there's lots of talk in here. Every time I read where he's talking about, you know, how people don't see genre as respectable, and I just have to remind myself I'm reading a book from, you know, that was published in 84, you know, the year after I was born, and realized that he's not talking about the present anymore, because that's, I mean, anybody who sits around and goes, you can't seriously study science fiction, or you can't take a class in college that has a science fiction book in it, and that class is a serious class, like, that's gone. That doesn't exist anymore. Well, I mean, unless you go to, like, pretentious university, which is a university now. I'm just going to invent it, so just be called Pretentious University for pretentious students.
I like that its initials are PU.
Perfect. Sarah, you had your hand up, so why don't you jump in?
Yeah, there is a very important reason to study science fiction and to study it from its origins through into the 21st century. And it was Ursula Le Guin who said it, is that we cannot really write about the future. We can only write about the present. So when we are looking at science fiction, we are looking at people projecting hopes and fears of the present, the social status of the present, into this imagined future. And that is important for the exact reasons we've been talking about. What gets put in? What gets left out? What are pointed up as the flaws of humanity? What are pointed up as the strengths? Who gets to be in the future, and what do they get to do there? That's vital.
Mm. One other thing I was curious about, because I completely agree with what you're saying there, Sarah, too, and there's also a sense that the community is doing that own thing within itself maybe that's not the guiding question, but it certainly seems like a question being answered is, you know, how do we make, what are our flaws and how do we make for a better genre community, as it were? And I don't know how true this is for those of you, I apologize to have to put it this way, but who have been on this earth slightly longer than I have.
I'm old.
Okay. Well, I appreciate the honesty. But clearly maybe Steena, you're not, I don't know. Anyway, point is you've all had a slightly different perspective of genre than I have, because most of my years within it have involved the internet, with some exception of some years when I wasn't really involved because I was, like, watching X-Men on the TV. Right. So my experience of watching genre grow in some sense as a community is watching the internet explode. And I mean, just look at, like, the last couple of years have been really intense discussions about things like gender and race. There have been some discussions about religion. There's been discussions about the politics within. I mean, right last month, there was the huge Science Fiction, Fantasy, and Writers Association kerfluffle squared and then cubed. So it seems like in some way the community has become more socially conscious on one scale, or at least more willing to speak out, or members within it at least are willing to speak out. I don't know if that's actually true, but that's what it seems like to me.
I feel like women are more comfortable speaking out than ever before, and I think that's why we're actually hearing about it now, and we didn't as much back when I was younger. But then maybe I was a child. What did I know?
Sarah
has her hand up.
Surprise. Okay. There are a couple of things going on in here. The first is that part of the reason this is happening is because more and more science fiction books that are accessed by young readers are aimed not at boys, but at girls. And this is a radical shift. The acknowledgement, at least on the young adult shelves and in the mangas and in at least some of the movies, that an important part of the audience for the genre of science fiction is women and girls. There were no, except for Meg Murray and Podcane, which don't get me started, there were no books aimed at girls when I was coming up. There was Andre Norton a little bit. There was Anne McCaffrey a little bit, but it was a distinct minority. Ursula Le Guin, gotta get Ursula in there. But now, if you look around the shelves, the young adult shelves, there is marvelous science fiction being written with young female protagonists. I'm looking at my shelf back here, and I'm seeing Scott Westerfeld's Ugly Pretties and Specials, this fantastic book called Skinned, about a girl who wakes up in an android body. There's one called Across the Universe that has a major physical flaw in it, but it does the scene of getting ready to go aboard the sleep ship in a way I had never even imagined. So there's all kinds of wonderful stuff being done out there, but it is being done with a female audience in mind, and that is brand new, and it's causing tensions.
Stina, you wanted to jump in, and then I'm going to jump in over you.
Okay. I just wanted to say, I very recently read an article that implied that science fiction, as opposed to fantasy, was actually getting more respect these days, but fantasy still hadn't earned its way out of the literary... always has. Oh, well, you know, there you are. But it was very interesting, I thought, because a majority of the time, like in YA, a majority of the writers are female. A majority of the writers who write fantasy tend to be female. And even if you're trying to write fantasy, because I write both fantasy and science fiction, women will generally get shunted into the fantasy section, even if they are writing science fiction. And because it's not quote unquote hard science fiction. So I thought that was an interesting article, and I thought I'd throw that out there. I know it's probably, I mean, sexism isn't the topic, but I'd throw that out there.
Well, my comment was going to be something kind of related to this, and now you made me think of some other things, Stina. What's very interesting is even though that, you know, science fiction has become a more specific, it's become a more approved thing in academia. At the same time, there are still lots of little infighting games. So when you look at like the children's literature side of literary studies, there are actually arguments among scholars about whether to include young adult literature in there. I'm dead serious. Like, people have these I mean, in academic terms, what would be fist fights over this? Obviously, nice. They're not punching each other, but, you know, metaphorically speaking, they're punching each other with words. But they're really having a fight over whether to include it. Like, it's not for kids, and it's like, well, but it's not technically adults either. Like, they're in between, and, like, we can't really create, like, in-betweeners literature. As amusing as that title would be, it doesn't – like, it belongs in that field because that's a part of a growing up experience. And, of course, when you look at young adult literature, a lot of it shares – similar thematic concerns as even stuff for like the chapter books, whatever the age, I forget the age group that's like fifth graders or something, chapter books.
Chapter books are, I'm sorry,
like fifth, sixth graders. I forget
mid grade is what I'm thinking of.
You get like the kind of growing up kind of questions. Obviously young adult is dealing with a slightly more quote unquote adult subject matter, but yeah, Sarah, I put it in there. 8 to 12 is mid grade, 13 to 18 is young adult. So,
and but, chapter books, I thought those were just like the beginning readers, but then
you may be right. I'm just thinking about not picture books and not the like mid grade. I don't know. Point is, there is infighting. And then the other thing I did want to say has now completely escaped my mind, but it was related. Oh, okay. Which was more just a question, and I wonder if because one of the interesting things, like when you look at the roots of cyberpunk, one of the things that's interesting about the cultural movements that precede it, like punk movement, is there's actually a lot of really interesting work on sort of looking at the historical movement of punks. And one of the things is you learn over time that that group, that like teenagers group, actually becomes a demographic for selling stuff to them. And that's part of what the punk movement was in response to, was in this sort of where basically everything is being mass. It turned into a mass consumption where you're actually taking demographic groups and creating product explicitly to sell it to them. And I wonder if on some level, maybe not in a kind of the ominous way I just put it, but if the shift in the publishing industry towards books that are marketed for women is oddly enough the sudden realization by publishing that, my God, women read books. Maybe we should market books to them. The stunning observation on their part, but
every once in a while somebody wakes up in the gaming industry and goes, oh my God, women play games!
What? No.
Oh my God!
No, that's not possible.
And then they go back. Somebody conks them on the head, and then they go back to sleep.
People would say that to Anita Sarkeesian when she was starting her videos. They're like, "Yo, what are you talking about? You're a woman. You don't play games." It's like she's wanting to raise money to do a thing about games. Clearly, she's going to play the games.
Clearly, she's been playing the games all along. That's it. Women are. That's one of the things that kind of bothers me about the science fiction community is that women have been so invisible for so long, and not just women, but minorities in general. It just, yeah.
Anyway, I'm sorry. Okay. Sarah, last comment, and then we'll go to talking about everybody's work except my own, because I'm the only one who's not a published author. So, I've got short stories, but that doesn't count. So,
I'm going to withdraw the hand because this isn't the beginning. This isn't the end of a conversation when we're coming to women and minorities in science fiction. It's the beginning.
That's a fair point. Well, so, if we do an episode where we talk about something a little more along those lines, we should definitely get you back and we'll do a full on hash out of a specific topic. Because let's just face it, at some point in the next year, there's going to be another fail of some description.
You better believe it.
Yep. It'll probably happen right before WizCon.
Yeah, or during WizCon.
I do want to say this, though. I must send a particular shout out to people like John Scalzi and Jim Hines, who have really taken up the banner and the cause to help make the fan community more accessible, more welcoming, and more opening. And they have taken it from pioneering people like Samuel Delaney, like Vonda McIntyre, like Ursula Le Guin, Judith Tarr, I mean, too many to mention, who really fought the wars when the culture wars were even more serious than they are now, to make sure that science fiction opened up and represented everybody. The late, great Octavia Butler, is another person I could mention. Joe Haldeman is another.
I've met him.
So it isn't all grim gloom and doom. People are working in it. And I see the future of science fiction as very bright.
And just another name to throw out, because I guess because she sort of was behind the scenes in the SFWA, but Mary Robinette Kowal.
Yes, who, yes, absolutely.
She got quite frustrated in that recent kerfluffle because, of course, she's doing all this work behind the scenes, which nobody sees because it would be probably really boring to all of us. But at the same time, you know, like when there was the Mr. Angry Man, I'll just call him that, she got really frustrated because a lot of people were threatening to leave the organization. From her perspective, it's
well, and some of them did,
and some of them did, and I don't disagree with their decision to do so because I understand it. I understand exactly why, but I also understand Mary's position. She's in that awful place where it's like, I'm doing all of this work, but and she actually wrote a post later where she basically just said, these bastards who are pissing all over everything and making people feel uncomfortable so that they want to leave. I don't blame the people that leave. I blame all of these assholes, basically. That's like the
angry
really
weasels.
Yeah. Angry weasels. Yeah. And of course, the angry weasels came out and were like, what? You shut up. And just, yeah.
Yeah. Like they do.
Like they do. They usually do. Yeah. Yeah. It's fun, though. It's fun to read the crazy because no, it's not. Never mind. There's nothing fun about it. Okay, so let's go to something that's very happy so we can end the show on a happy note. And that's to talk about everybody's work. So so we'll start with you, Sarah, because you're on the left side of my screen. So first, tell people where they can find you and tell us a little bit about your new book. I don't know if it actually was new. I just know I bought it. So it was on BNN and I saw your name and I was like, I'm going to buy that.
People who want to find out about what's going on with me and find more out about my work and my books can go to www.sarahzatel.com. All of my science fiction is available in ebook format from Open Road Media. In fact, I'm on sale this month. I take it back. There's one title that is not available there, and that's Kingdom of Cages. I'm holding that one back because there may be a sequel. Currently on the shelves, I have got a couple of things. I have got a young adult series, The American Fairy Trilogy. The first two books are out, Dust Girl and Bad Luck Girl. That's about, they're set in the 1930s. They are about a young woman named Callie LaRue who, well, she knows she's half African American, but she's just found out she's also half fairy. And we're off to the races. I also have a straight historical coming out later this year, also young adult, called Palace of Spies.
Ooh. And the book I bought was Fool's War.
Ah, good choice.
I don't know why I didn't remember. It's right there. It looks beautiful on my Barnes & Noble library. It's just sitting there with the little person with the eyeball.
Yes, that's a good cover. That's the new ebook cover, and I'm very pleased with it.
It actually looks quite nice. So, yeah. So that I bought it. So there you go.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Like I said, you probably got like 18 cents from me, but you know what? That 18 cents will go towards getting you a candy bar.
No check so small you can't use it.
Fair enough. So everybody should definitely go check out your book so they can go to Zara Zettel, that's Zettel, but I'll put a link in the show notes too. You can check out all of her books. She's got quite a few, and I believe you mentioned you do write under a pseudonym as well, called which is C.L. Anderson, so check them out. There's lots of books, and you can go on Amazon or BNN and get Kindle or...
Or IndieBound.
There's another one, yeah. Yep, if you would like to avoid the multinational conglomerate.
Zombie.
Which the zombie, yeah, as Mike would say, zombies. Alrighty, Mike. So where can people find you? And tell us a little bit about, you've got three books out, I believe, so far. And I know you're working on another one at the moment.
I don't have three books out. I only have one out, but... there's another one which should be out in the next couple of months, and I'm working on a sequel to that one, and there's another one drafted but needs a serious rewrite. So you were about in the right ballpark as far as how many, but not all of them are published yet. They're the Griffin Clark's series, and they're secondary world fantasy, steampunkish, with a bit of a twist, not your usual homage to Victorian colonialism. They're more your post-colonial style steampunk, I suppose, in which the pale pasty elves are the colonists. And yeah, they are about social change occurring through technological change and emancipation of the gnomes from their industrialist dwarvish oppressors and all that kind of good stuff.
You describe that, they're industrialist dwarf oppressors.
I love it.
No holds barred. You just go right into it.
Well, to me, that's a lot of what the 19th century was about. It wasn't necessarily about the exploring and the white man's burden so much as the fact that people who weren't the white man and weren't the man started to get a bit of a voice in things. And I mean, I myself am white male, middle class, and heterosexual, so to have any more hegemony, I'd have to be dead, but that doesn't mean that I have to write about myself.
That's a fair point. No, I actually, I'm a Caribbean lit person, so my, I'm technically a contemporary person, but my PhD project is actually looking through the kind of imperial project in the Caribbean since basically its inception, at least in the British West Indies is where I'm focusing. But so there's a lot of very interesting, I say interesting and in a completely academic sense, not in a, I'm very fascinated by how these people were oppressed. No, that's not true. But the changes, the social changes that you see in the Caribbean are really, really quite fascinating over time, particularly after the emancipation in late 1830s. Very interesting. But it's very different in the Caribbean than what you see in other parts of the British Empire. It's just a very different world, in large part because the Caribbean was so damn far away. And by the end of the 18th century, a lot of people in the British Empire were like, why do we even want to keep these colonies since they don't make us any money? So that was a real concern. They were like, there are people arguing over, like, what do we do with these places that we can get sugar for cheaper from elsewhere, guys? We don't need to do this. And yeah, that's like the really, really watered down, pathetic version of Caribbean history. So that's a horrible, horrible history. I will never do that again. So anyway, and so people can find you where again, Mike?
Okay, my main website is at Seaside Media. That's the letter C, Side Media, all one word, .com. And if you put a / Griffin Clark's on the end of that, spelling Griffin the British way, GRYPHON, then you'll get to my blog. Or you can just Google for indie books worth reading, because I have a page where I talk about other people's indie books, and that's the first result for indie books worth reading on Google.
We're going to have to point you to Book View Cafe. It's the internet's largest professional authors cooperative. We put out a lot of independent books worth reading.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, I think I've stumbled across it. I need to look into that some more.
Absolutely. Yeah, that'd be great. How do you know? When you go to Book View Cafe, the first thing that shows up is a Judith Tarr novel.
See?
Yeah. Okay, so, and then lastly, Stina.
Yay! You can find me at cslight, LEICHT.com. And I have coming out a short story called Texas Died for Somebody's Sins, But Not Mine.
Oh my gosh.
Thanks. It's in Ray Guns Over Texas. It's an anthology that's coming out at the end of the month at WorldCon. Woo! I have two books out, Of Blood and Honey and Blue Skies from Pain.
And they are set in the 1970s in Northern Ireland during the Troubles. And yeah, that's it, I guess. I guess I stopped there.
Excellent. And you're working on something.
Oh, yeah. I've got a new series that I'm working on right now that it's set in – it's a secondary world fantasy set in the 18th century. A 18th century. It's not our 18th century, but
That would be kind of weird, a secondary world fantasy set in our 18th century.
Yeah, whatever.
All right, awesome. Well, hopefully you will make sure that'll come out. I don't know when that'll probably next year at the earliest, but yeah.
We'll see. We'll see.
Well, don't worry. I will make sure to get at least 6 people to buy it.
Yay!
Oh, that's fun. Okay, so, well, thank you, Sarah, for coming on the show and also for calling me out on saying something stupid. I appreciate it.
All part of the service. Thank you very much for inviting me.
And thank you, Mike, for, you did only wake up at, you know, this morning, but you did happen to go on a trip to Australia, and so you were quite tired. So thank you for coming on today and talking with us and giving us your perspective.
Entirely my pleasure.
And, of course, Stina, you've been here before, but thank you for actually, you came in quite last minute, so thank you for showing up at the last possible minute.
Well, you're very welcome. Thanks for asking me.
And I'll see everybody who listens with whatever comes next. So, and bye.
Bye. Bye.
See y'all.
If you would like to send us hate mail on this episode or any other topics we've covered, you can do so in a number of ways. You can send us an email.
SkiffyandFanty@gmail.com.
You can send us a tweet.
@SkiffyandFanty.
Leave a comment on the blog.
SkiffyandFanty.com.
Go to Google Plus.
Shawnee Jen.
And or Facebook.
The Skiffy and Fanty Show. Our intro music comes from Time Flux by Revolution Void. You can check them out at freemusicarchive.org.
Another weak human afraid to face death.
I fart in your general direction.
France, different planet.
The Force will be with you. Always.
End of line.